This webcast is a service of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. More information at southdakotachannel.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this press conference on Medicaid expansion. My name is Kelsey Pritchard. I'm the Communications Director in the Governor's Office. And I just want to remind everyone on the phone line to please mute your lines now by pressing *6. And you can unmute during Q&A by pressing #6. And everyone in the room, please use the mics at the table during Q&A. And we would also ask that all questions at this press conference be related to Medicaid expansion. And if you have other questions, the governor will answer those at the end of the week at the legislative press conference. With that, I'll turn it over to Governor Dennis Dugard.
Good morning, and thank you to everyone who is here in the room or on the line for being present. Last Friday, you know, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services at Health and Human Services issued a 7-page state health officer letter, which outlines some significant policy changes that they have made. It was a year ago, you might remember, that we asked the federal government to reconsider the policies that they were following when they made payment for claims of those eligible for Indian Health Services who are also Medicaid eligible and seeking care outside Indian Health Services. Last fall, then, the federal government began serious conversations about this, about their policies. And then you might remember in October, they issued what they called a white paper in which they identified 4 major areas where they were considering some significant change, and they asked for comments. Our South Dakota Healthcare Coalition's or Solutions Coalition was among the commentators, as were a number of South Dakota tribes, as were many, as were the Great Plains Tribal Chairman's Health Board, and many other states and other states' tribes. I'm informed that about 75 different responses were made, some as simple as a single-page letter, for example, from the governor of Wyoming, to multiple-page, very specific comments directed at very particular policies. So it was a fair amount of response. And we continue to have very encouraging discussions with Indian Health Services and with the Secretary of Health and Human Services. I've had multiple phone conversations with Secretary Burwell. I've been in her office with her twice about this. And we've also had a number of federal officials come out to South Dakota, both from Health and Human Services. The top leader in Medicaid came out to South Dakota, along with some leaders from Indian Health Services. I'm confident of the commitment at the federal level to make these policy changes work. And we were, as I mentioned last Thursday, we were aware that the state health officer letter was imminent, but we weren't sure when it would be issued, and we're very pleased then it was issued the following afternoon, Friday afternoon. Including today, though, there are only 10 days left in the legislative session. Of those 10 days, the last 4 are reserved for conference committees and for consideration of vetoes. So that leaves only 6 days, including today, within which the legislature could take action on Medicaid expansion. In those 6 days, we have to evaluate the impact of the policy changes that were laid out in the letter on Friday. We have to assess the time it will take to implement the changes that would be permitted under those policies, to communicate the financial impacts to the legislature, and to ask for their evaluation, even as education funding and many other significant issues are still commanding their attention. So given this time frame, I've concluded that to urge the legislative approval of a Medicaid expansion decision this session would not give the legislature adequate time to give fair and dispassionate consideration to the proposal. Accordingly, I'm going to be asking the legislative appropriators to amend the general appropriation bill to remove the federal funding authority, which would enable expansion in fiscal year 17. Now, let me be clear that this does not mean that we are done. We will continue to work on a plan to implement the federal policy and to determine if it will free up sufficient funds to enable South Dakota to afford Medicaid expansion. And I want to thank the many people who've expressed support for my plan so far. More than 80 hospitals and clinics representing the medical communities have expressed their support. Another 50 groups representing businesses, religious groups, and consumer organizations have offered their support as well. I want to thank Kim Olsen-Risden, our Secretary of Health, who's here with me, for all the time she and her staff have been putting into this proposal, and the time and the relationship she's developed with Vicki Wachino, the head of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, is part of the reasons why we are here today and have made the progress we've made. We are moving ahead on several key implementation areas, and the South Dakota Healthcare Solutions Coalition will be working on these. First, in the area of telehealth, especially emergency room and specialty physician services to be provided for Indian Health Service eligible patients. You might recall that the Indian Health Services had asked for sources of telehealth providers to offer the explanations and extent of the services they could provide to Indian Health Services. Those responses are due tomorrow. So they are proceeding quickly, and hopefully will be able to offer a menu of telehealth services to all of the Great Plains Indian Health Service service units by June. On another front, the coalition will be working toward development of satellite clinics that will be able to serve IHS eligibles outside the current IHS system. They'll be working on behavioral health services, increasing access to those services in Indian Country. They'll be working on hospital transition services, how to ensure that hospital care is paid with 100% federal funds and people get follow-up services after their hospital stay. As I've said in the past, I will not expand Medicaid without approval by the legislature and the tribes, and the decision today does not change this. That means if a plan comes together, it would need to get legislative approval next session or in a special session. Let me reiterate, my support would be for a plan to expand Medicaid that will not cost the state more general funds than we are spending today. And I will not move forward if I'm not confident the plan can be implemented. However, I remain committed to seeing this through, and I'm very optimistic that I will be able to recommend Medicaid expansion when the plan is right for South Dakota. What questions do you have?
I have a clarification with it. With this plan, would a tribal member need to be referred to a non-IHS facility in order for it to fall into the category of this expansion, or if one just opts to go to a non-IHS facility, would that be covered as well with 100% reimbursement?
Good question. One of the things that is very clear in the state health officer letter is that for 100% federal reimbursement to be provided, a patient must obtain their care through Indian Health Services, which means they must begin with a provider that is connected to Indian Health Services in one fashion or another.
Then I have a follow-up. With the numbers or the estimates you were giving during the state of the, which one was it? I don't know, the budget address, did those include, were you only considering people who would be referred, or does that number include, or the number of savings include people who would just opt to go to a non-IHS facility?
We were looking at the numbers, not where we would find the savings. We were looking rather at how much we needed to find in savings. We identified $57 million as the amount of savings we would need to find by fiscal year 2021. In the near term, say fiscal year 17, we need to find at least $12 million in ongoing savings to enable us to expand Medicaid without any extra general fund costs. So Now we have the policy that's laid out in the state health officer letter, and we know that, for example, if we have a child, let's say, for example, who is on one of the reservations and goes to the Indian health care or Indian health services provider there, starts her care there, and because it's a specialty care that she needs that's not provided at that facility, if she gets referred to a non-Indian health services provider, so long as there is an agreement between the non-Indian health care provider and the IHS service unit, and so long as there's continued coordination of care by the IHS provider, and we'd have to set up an exchange of medical information. We do have a health information exchange where that could be done electronically. So long as those things are established, it's very clear that in those instances, we would be able to recover 100% reimbursement. Now, I'll go on to say, it's important that there be an incentive for those non-Indian health service providers to enter into those agreements. It's important that there be an incentive for the Indian Health Service unit to enter into an agreement like that. And right now there is no incentive, because today that child can be and is being referred to the non-IHS provider. And that provider is providing the care, and they're sending the bill to South Dakota, and we're paying it. So from the Indian Health Service unit's perspective and from the non-IHS provider's perspective, they don't care how they get paid. Right now, they're getting paid. Right now, that child's getting service. The only beneficiary by that arrangement is the state. The state gets reimbursed at 100% instead of about 50%. So the incentive is provided if those two parties understand that South Dakota is committed to expanding Medicaid if those arrangements are entered into. Otherwise, there's no incentive. So the expansion of Medicaid is the incentive to get some of these arrangements to be put in place. And the letter is very clear that no coercion. We can't discourage people from not entering into these agreements. All we can do is incent them. We can encourage them to do it. And so that's why some will say, oh, South Dakota will achieve these savings without expanding Medicaid. And those speakers don't understand the practical realities that many of these arrangements, there is no incentive to rearrange how payments are reimbursed from the federal government unless there's a Medicaid expansion that benefits them in some other way.
I apologize if you answered it and it didn't sink in. So I apologize if it's a repeat. But wasn't there an amount that you gave that there would be in savings, and then you said that we would realize that amount almost immediately, but we wouldn't have to find that much in savings till 2021? Or wasn't there an estimate amount that you gave?
Yeah, what I gave was, again, not the savings that we would get from one approach or another. I identified the savings we need to find, because that is the cost of expansion. So, for example, in fiscal year 17, we would need to find $12 million, roughly, of savings. And then in 2018, it jumps to something over $20 million, and so on, all the way up to $57 million in fiscal year 2021.
Okay, so they're just, I'm remembering it wrong. There wasn't an estimate of what would be saved. Okay,
that's
thanks.
Right.
Governor, you're confident that this is going to come up in the 27th legislature and will be addressed then, or might this take more time than that?
Am I confident that this will come up in the 2017 session, or will it take more time than that? I think it may take less time than that, and I'm hopeful we might be able to address it in a special session if the savings can be identified and if implementation is practically realistic. Because again, we have to identify where these expenditures are occurring and where we might get some of these contracts in place, and the willingness of those contracting parties to enter into contracts like that, as an example.
Governor, I think the number he was looking for is how much the state paid in fiscal 2015 as its share of Medicaid on people who would be eligible for IHS benefits but went to non-IHS providers.
Okay,
and there has been a number
on that. Well, there was $67 million total that was paid in situations where you had a person who's eligible for Indian Health Services care. They're Native American or they're on the reservation and they're enrolled in one of those situations that enabled them to be eligible for Indian Health Services, but they were also today eligible for Medicaid. So they were dually eligible, and there were situations like the first one I gave where the child went for their primary care. If they were provided care at Indian Health Services, no question, they get 100% reimbursement. They send the bill to Medicaid. Medicaid pays Indian Health Services, and Medicaid gets 100% reimbursement. If that child couldn't get care at the Indian Health Service, he or she would be referred off to a non-IHS provider. The bill gets sent to Medicaid by that provider. The state's on the hook for half. And situations like that, or where we paid a pharmaceutical bill for that person, or that person went direct, lived in Rapid City, didn't even start at IHS, went straight to Rapid City Regional, or they lived in Sioux Falls and went straight to Avera or Sanford. Those will all be examples where the person was dually eligible and got care from a non-IHS provider one way or another. And so there's multiple avenues that those situations are following and reaching care through those avenues. And each of them presents a unique opportunity with its unique barriers to finding our way to 100% reimbursement. And so we need to evaluate in each of those situations, how can we rearrange this process in such a way that comports with the state health officer letter, because it's very clear in the letter what may and very clearly states what may not be done. If you've read the letter or looked at it, there's very clear statements about what is not allowed. And so we have to look at what is allowed and what, how long it'll take to get those things in place, if there's contracts, where those contracts, who writes them, and what approvals are required. So it seems simple in terms of the policy change, but implementation is really where you really have to understand that it just doesn't happen by throwing a switch.
Sorry, if I got one clarification. So then, it would, like, to use that $67 million you said it was number, that wouldn't necessarily be in savings, because that would also include people who just opted to go straight to a non-IHS facility.
Right. The 67 includes people who went straight to a non-IHS facility, which very clearly, under the state health officer letter today, we can't capture that savings, except maybe through some special project or something like that. But without some demonstration project or some other kind of unique approval of a special arrangement, the norm will disallow 100% reimbursement in those situations. In other words, we asked the very question, could, if Dennis is a tribal member living in Sioux Falls, Dennis went straight to Sanford or Avera, could those entities have a contract with Indian Health Services so that Dennis could be seen as going to those places as an agent of Indian Health Services, and thereby Dennis got his care through IHS? And the answer was no, unequivocally no. So unless we can get some sort of special demonstration project, which we maybe could, but again, it's not just throwing the switch. The policy's on, so now we can start sending 100% bills to the federal government. Nope, doesn't work that way.
Is that the expectation you had when you were pitching it to the, and I know there were you had several conditions, but when you were pitching it during the budget address, did you have that understanding that a referral would be necessary to get the 100% reimbursement?
I knew that was a question, because we have been asking that question off and on, and we were uncertain about the answer, because sometimes language is unclear. And so that's why, I want to say 3 or 4 weeks ago, we resorted to very specific fact patterns instead of asking the questions conceptually, we said, okay, here's a fact pattern. Dennis lives in Sioux Falls. Dennis goes here. Dennis does that. Would his bill qualify for 100% FMAP? The answer is no.
Others with questions in the room?
When does the 100% start? I mean, is it in effect right now?
I would say it's in effect right now, if it's implemented.
Yeah.
And Kim, maybe you want to answer that.
The policy is the state health official letter is clear that the policy is in effect now at the federal level, but you have to be able to comport with it, and so it has to be able to be implemented.
Yes, here's a question.
Given that the policy is in effect right now, if Avera, Sanford, a non-IHS facility, wants to take advantage of this and bill IHS instead of Medicaid, just how many steps do they have to take? Do they have to just sign an agreement with an IHS facility, or is there more to it?
Yeah, it's more complicated than that. Right now, these situations would involve a provider sending a bill to Medicaid. In all these cases, the bill comes to Medicaid. And the question is, when Medicaid goes to the federal government for a share of the bill, will the federal government pay 100% reimbursement or will they pay partial reimbursement? Today, or I should say prior to Friday, it was clear we'd just get partial reimbursement. To get 100% reimbursement, there has to be in place, for example, in the non-IHS provider, there has to be a contractual relationship between that provider and IHS, and IHS must still have responsibility for coordinating the health care of that patient. So outside the IHS world, imagine I'm a primary care provider, and I'm an independent practitioner, and you come to me for a health care issue. You're my patient. I would serve you if you're Medicaid eligible. I would serve you if I can't do what you need done. You need some surgery that I don't do, or you need some cancer treatment that I don't do, or some other kind of specialty. I'd refer you, but that referring doc would still have a communication back to me, and you would remain my patient. And so what we need to have is, in all these situations, Indian Health Service has to be involved in the care. And you can't, as an Indian Health Service eligible patient who's also Medicaid, just go straight to a non-IHS, regardless of a contract. IHS still has to be a coordinating participant in that. And they were very clear about that in the state health officer letter.
Do you see some of the language that they're giving you or this delayed timing as a setback in this process? And I know you said you're optimistic about being able to get this going, possibly in special session. How are you going to make that happen?
Well, first of all, I do not see it as a setback. I was hopeful that things would proceed a little more quickly than they have. And I know that there was a desire on all fronts for that to occur, at the federal level as well. I was also aware that what they do at the federal level impacts all states. So it's not as if they can have a conversation with us alone. I'm sure they were having conversations with many states. Alaska is also very interested in this and is potentially significantly impacted as we are. Oklahoma has a very significant Native American population. They'll be impacted. So as much as I wanted them to plunge ahead and offer a letter that suits South Dakota, they've got a broader audience that they need to attend to. That being said, I remain optimistic that we will find a way to implement this through means that will provide the savings at the time we need those savings to offset the cost of Medicaid expansion. Now what we need to do, now that we have it in black and white, we know what the policy allowances are and what the prohibitions are. We can move ahead and find that narrow lane that leads to savings, whether it be through pharmaceutical care or referred specialty care or primary care through a demonstration project or whatever. Find those avenues through long-term care. Find those avenues that provide the savings that enable us to expand Medicaid. And with that promise of expansion, those who can help us find that saving will be motivated to help us find it. They'll be motivated to enter into those contracts, because even though it doesn't help them in those areas where they're contract and serving already, it'll help us find the dollars to provide better care to many more people, and care for which those providers will be paid. And they're not being paid today in many of those situations.
Are there any questions on the phone line? Any other questions in the room?
Governor, early in your comments...
I have a question.
Stand by. There's a question in the room, and then you can go. Stand by.
Sorry.
Go ahead, Bob.
Okay. Early in your comments, you said that some people have talked about using these savings for other purposes, and you said they don't understand the situation. And what I inferred from that comment is that there are some sort of constraints on what these savings could be used for.
No, I mean to say, some people say, let's take the savings and use them for other things. And I think that presumes that they're proceeding from the assumption that the savings can be captured. And I'm saying they can be captured, but they will not be captured unless those whose behavior must change for us to capture them are incented to change. Those non-IHS providers have to be incented to have a contract with IHS. They have to be incented to work through the health information exchange and exchange information with an IHS provider. And that's work that they don't have to do now, because they are serving Medicaid-eligible people and getting paid for it. And changing this contracting situation and this health information exchange won't give them any more money for the patients they're serving today who are Medicaid eligible, unless they will get paid for patients they're serving today for whom they're not getting payment. And that only works if there's expansion. So why would any of these providers go through all the work to create contracts? Why would the tribes even want to do it? Or why would IHS want to do it? Because again, you will jump back to that example I used. That little girl who went to Rosebud, she's still getting served. She gets served at IHS. She gets served at Rapid City Regional. And they get paid. That won't change. It's just how much will the state get reimbursed that changes. And if we take that reimbursement and spend it on Medicaid expansion, that's the incentive to get all these providers to go through all the hoops they have to go through in order for us to recover that 100% FMAP. And I don't think they're being disingenuous when they say, oh, let's spend it on other things. I think they just don't understand that it's not going to happen without some incentive to these providers to make that happen. They got other fish to fry.
We'll go back to the phone lines. There was a question.
Yes, so the policy is now in effect at the federal level. So is anything different within South Dakota's healthcare system because of that today than it was, you know, last Thursday?
What's different today than what it was last Thursday? Well, the opportunity is different. I would say, will South Dakota obtain 100% reimbursement where we haven't been? No, we won't. Not unless we can enter into some of these contracts and get some of this health information exchanged, get a demonstration project, something like that. But otherwise, without those implementation steps occurring, the FMAP split won't change.
I could ask one more. Do you know, are there any type of agreements or anything in place that could easily transition into the type of contract that was outlined as required by the letter? Do you know if there's anything in South Dakota that would be close to that?
Well, one thing that we asked them to do, as we asked for the state health officer letter, because we foresaw that implementation would be the next barrier. Once we have the policy changed, then of course implementation is the next challenge. And we know from other circumstances, for example, when the Veterans Administration entered into a contract in Wagner to provide VA care in Wagner, they had a contract that was over 150 pages long. And that had to be negotiated between that unit and the federal government. Well, if each of these Indian Health Service units had to enter into a 150-page contract that they negotiated separately, one at a time, would that even happen? I don't know that that would even happen in South Dakota. So one of the things we asked them is, we need some sort of a streamlined contract that has been approved, pre-approved at the highest levels, that you can just lay on the desk at an Indian Health Service unit and say, you fill in the blanks and this will serve as an adequate contract. And we got a draft of that the same day we got the health letter. And it's got some errors in it that we need to work through, but it's a very good, relatively simple contract that could be entered into and hopefully start leading toward this 100% reimbursement. Again, though, that's just one of the obstacles. Then health information exchange would be another. And then the willingness of the parties and the interest of the parties in doing something like that has to be there as well. Yes.
You've spoken of the incentive that the non-IHS providers have to engage in these agreements with IHS facilities, being that that will encourage then the Medicaid expansion to happen, if I'm understanding it correctly.
Right. It will enable it because it will create the savings that finance it.
Right, right. So I guess that was my question there. Do those non-IHS facilities have any incentive to do this before they know Medicaid expansion is going to happen? It sounds like you're saying, well, it's going to happen if you find us the savings that we can capture. So it's on their shoulders to make this happen now.
It certainly can't happen without their commitment and involvement, because we can't get the savings without them going through the hoops that they must go through so that we can demonstrate the care is provided through IHS. That is, there's a relationship, there's continued communication between the non-IHS provider and the IHS service unit, and there's an exchange of health information. Yes.
So just to check, the non-IHS providers who are going through this calculus right now, do they have enough incentive to go find those to capture those savings for us now if they don't know that the legislature would approve Medicaid expansion in the end?
I guess we'd have to. I think it would be set out in such a way that we would have to demonstrate to them what the financial advantage is. We'd quantify it for them. We'd have to also explain what the hoops are so they understand how much work it is. And then they should decide whether or not the financial gain that would be available to them by going through the hoops would be worth it. And then we'd have their commitment that if indeed the legislature approves expansion, then they would then go through the hoops to create the FMAP savings we'd need created.
One last one, I hope.
Yes, Bob.
What has to happen? I mean, what threshold is in your mind for when you're ready to proceed on a special session?
We need to have the conversations with the non-IHS providers and the IHS providers who could create the savings necessary for year one. And then we'd also have to have a pretty good confidence level, a very good confidence level, that we could also gain enough implementation steps that we could ramp up those savings in years 2, 3, 4, and 5. So that by the time we got to FY21, we'd have the $57 million in savings, not just, say, $12 million. We don't need all 57 in year one, but we have to have a pretty high confidence level that as the cost to the state would ramp up, the savings on the FMAT side would also be ramping up at the same time, or better than the cost. The savings would be better than the cost.
Any other questions?
Kelsey, I have one here on the phone. Governor, you talked earlier about use the Wagner example, and the tribe is doing a lot of joint ventures or contracting with say Avera, how will that fit this mosaic? Does that count as IHS, so to speak, like the Veterans Clinic, the blood dialysis, or how will that work in all of this where it maybe isn't specifically an IHS facility?
Well, it has to be with an IHS facility. The IHS facility has to have the care coordination responsibility for the patient. The fact that there is some relationship already is certainly a very great positive. And so I would think that would make it more likely that we could get some of these non-IHS providers to agree to work through these steps. And so, again, the fact that there is some there are some examples of relationships that exist, that's a very positive thing, and we certainly want to build on those. But we need to be sure that to the extent that we need to jump through different hoops than they have jumped through to create the relationship they've got, that we explain the difference in the contracting relationship, the nature of the agreement, the way information is exchanged, that sort of thing, the way the IHS facility is retained in the loop of patient care. That has to be, we have to comply with that because the letter is very clear about certain things must be present if we want to be able to claim 100% FMAP.
Okay, great. And Governor, a positive thing is a lot of this heavy lifting is done now. There's a lot of template. They don't, like you said, they don't have to start from scratch and do a 100-some-page contract. This should simplify things much more for the tribes if they want to pursue these kind of things.
Yes. Oh, that was the streamlined contract is absolutely essential because having seen the Wagner example at the VA contract, it's the opposite extreme. It's to the point where you've got to have a flagpole in the sidewalk, a certain distance, you have to have certain signs. The contracts just go into ridiculous detail when the patients really just care about getting good care. And couldn't we hang a flag on the wall instead? I mean, it's kind of ridiculous.
Anything else?
Appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us.
All right, thank you, everyone.